Accession number 28653, Mr. Francis Lucas, Reel 10. Now, what happened when you landed? You were sort of describing the situation as you're approaching.
Yes. So, together with dozens of other tank landing craft, we sailed towards the shore, and then I don't know how far from the shore, when the water was reasonably shallow, the ramps were let down, and we drove off. Now, we have previously, which I should have mentioned, waterproofed our vehicles. And that had been one of the things that we had been working on when we were in the East Ham Stadium.
Well, tell us about that now. Well, how did you waterproof the vehicles? You might as well drop that in.
Yes. We were supplied with rolls and rolls of waterproof sheeting, together with dozens of tins of Bostik and other stuff, and yards of piping. And what happened, every significant part of the engine, like distributor and so on, we put sheeting round and sealed it with Bostik. From the carburetor, we fitted pipes that went up through the roof of the cab, and again sealed their joints and so on. All our equipment, again, was wrapped in this waterproof sheeting and sealed. And I should have mentioned, we did, in the stadium, spend, of course, a lot of time doing this, and we made absolutely sure that our personal effects, too, were well and truly sealed. And so the big idea was that the vehicle would be able to run literally underwater where its whole engine was submerged. We were advised to keep the whole time in low gear and keep the engine running at high revs. And this would be required, of course, for no more than, we say, half an hour or whatever. And so in our waterproof vehicles, we did drive down off the ramps, and I remember in particular in our vehicle, the water came roughly up to our knees when we were sitting in the cab and so on. But as the driver, Peter Creek, kept the engine going, and then he just flapped, I don't know for what reason. And suddenly, again, I don't know why, he began to turn back out into the deeper water. And I had no alternative, sitting beside him, to push him to one side, grabbing the steering wheel and directing it towards the shore. Now, a number of vehicles had completely floundered. Some, obviously, had got into a depression where the water is much deeper, and there were a number of lads sitting on the roof of their trucks, with the trucks almost completely submerged. And we were advised in such situations we did not have to waste time in trying to rescue them or to help in any way. We had to drive towards the beach, and that was that. Anyway, we did get somewhat off course. And by the time we got to the beach, I realized that we were not quite on our targeted landing area, but you couldn't do anything about that. And so we did reach, I should think, in the middle of the afternoon, we finally did drive up onto the beach. And then there was some sort of a bang or whatever, and my truck, and I was travelling in the heavy workshop truck, heeled right over. There were three of us on the truck. We jumped out and discovered that the rear wheel had been hit and the tyre just damaged. And,
hit by what?
That was that. Presumably must have been by shrapnel or something from somewhere. Goodness knows what. But the thing was flat, and we were stuck. And in the soft sand, it had healed over. We couldn't do a thing about it. We just stuck there, sitting under the truck, and we simply had to wait until the beach cleared, more or less. And that was several hours later. And there's not a thing we could do. And then the sun was setting, the evening was coming, the beach had largely cleared, and I thought, right, we've got to do something, but what can we do? And I went up onto the beach road, and several hundred yards down, I heard what was the sound of a tractor, and amazingly, although hours earlier it had been full of activity, now, unbelievably, it was almost deserted and quiet. And I drove down towards the sound of this tractor and found it was a Canadian, and a Canadian tractor. I realized then we'd landed in the Canadian area instead of our own area. And I got the fellow, who was very cooperative, to come down, put on the tow rope, and pull us up onto the hard shoulder, etc. Fortunately, we had a spare wheel, and even more fortunately, the had not been damaged to the extent so that we were able to change the wheel and eventually become mobile again. By that time, it was virtually dark, I remember, and I knew the general direction, which direction of the beach road our lads had vanished into. And so I thought, right, we've got to get away from the beach. And I well remember, and have since traced the route when we've been over subsequently. So I drove about a mile and a half up the beach road until I found a small road leading off. We went down there. There's a small village which seemed deserted. I found there an orchard, I remember. We drove our vehicle in there under the trees and bedded down there for the night. But we had landed and we were safe, and there we were. And then in the morning, it wasn't very difficult to drive on to eventually pick up our divisional signs and without a great deal of problem relink with our unit. And so we were in France. It comes back so very clearly. And then it seemed, as far as my memory goes, to be reasonably routine. We're with our unit.
Whereabouts? Do you know the nearby village? Or?
Oh, dear. I should have looked that up.
It doesn't matter.
I could possibly identify it. No, I can't. I can't tell you.
So what was the routine you fell into?
The routine was largely the same situation as we had established both in the desert and in Italy, of being there ready to deal with communication problems. We were obviously in one of the rear units, because that's where we're required to be to move up whenever necessary to deal with any communication problem. And so it was back to the job that we were so familiar with, and once more back in our own area of activity. So
what happens next?
Well, there, I cannot be specific beyond saying that we were with the general active advance, followed by periods of waiting and inactivity, taking us across France, into Belgium, into Holland, and so on. And just little things tend to stand out and so on. But by and large, it would be a period when we were active, and yet I find it difficult to sort out precise memories. And I suppose that is because the work now was fairly routine. What I do remember, of course, is going through some of the towns and the welcome you had.
Now, tell me about that. What was the sort of reception you got when you went to a French, French town?
Oh, absolutely fantastic. The people will soon be out on the streets, and there would be shouting, cheering, clapping, etc. One town, I forget what it was, there was obviously a match factory in that particular town, because the people seemed to have boxes and boxes of matches which they threw into our vehicles, and I remember we were almost swamped with matches. And in every place, they did endeavour to give us what they could. The younger, more active of the female sex would, of course, jump up on your truck and welcome you with typical French ardour, etc. And folk would be clapping and cheering. And it was a triumphal march.
Were you ever attacked by German Air Force or Luftwaffe? I mean, was there any... Because I know the Allies had aerial domination, but there were some air attacks.
Yes. Fortunately, I don't remember specifics. Yes, from time to time, you did hear the rumble of activity, more as in the background, but it seemed that we were far enough back not to feel any imminent danger or what have you. And it was a slow but triumphal progress, really.
Now, were there any particular communications problems you had to resolve, or was it...
Yes. From time to time, yes. The key communication factor was the command tank. And if its radio went down, that could be a problem. And from time to time, there were problems. But again, for us, they're routine, and the ones that you expected, and they were just dealt with by our lads, who had at that stage ample spares. You had to do very little repairs on the spot. Usually it's a matter of replacing equipment, of which we did have plenty at that time.
Now, any other, so just, I know it's a bit, any other sort of just bits you remember? Just incidents, or is it just much of a muchness as you move forward?
Much of a muchness. A highlight was indeed when we got into Belgium, where again we were given a fantastic welcome by the people there, and in Brussels in particular. Again, the streets were crowded, and you're really made to feel as if you're heroes. What one does remember, of course, is there was a predominance of older people and young people. And one realized, of course, that the active middle-aged group were not around, and so on. And, of course, since one realized the reason for that, they were involved actively elsewhere, and so on. So this steady advance continued until we got to Holland.
So this would be, what, September-ish? A bit late October?
It would be roundabout then. Unfortunately, we knew very little on the wider scene. And that was indeed frustrating in a way. We knew our own position, but not necessarily what was happening elsewhere. And when we got to Holland, we suddenly came to a complete halt. And it seemed that we were now sidelined and pulled out of the situation. In reading since some of the accounts of that campaign, it became obvious that it was decided that now we were putting for a break and others were taking the advance on forward. And so in Holland, we had what proved to be, again, an interesting time on the social side. And it seemed there was always this social side which became evident and you enjoyed. And in the little village called Ermond, somewhere in Holland, our unit was told to settle down in that village. And so we had a look around, a drive around, and I decided that we should occupy the area of the local vicarage, where there was a drive up and plenty of space. And so our three trucks, we pulled up into the drive of the local vicarage. A matter of courtesy, we did, of course, contact the priest and his domestic there, said what we're doing, and they're very happy.
And this was in the village or the town of?
Of Ermond.
Ermond.
Yeah, I think you are M-O-N-D. And we were indeed told we were very welcome there. And it turned out to be very much to our advantage. And indeed proved a very interesting time. As I say, activity had ceased then. And we realized that we were now, as far as army action was concerned, just put on reserve and sidelined. The priest there was a delightful old gentleman. The only other occupant of the vicarage was his domestic, a lady about middle age called Lisa. And Lisa looked after the priest, of course, and did all his domestic cooking and everything else. And Lisa immediately took us under her wing. And we were soon, I think on the second day, invited to come into the vicarage. We were allocated rooms there, it's quite a roomy place, and beds. And instead of sleeping on our trucks, we slept in the vicarage. Not only that, she insisted we handed over our army rations, and she performed miracles with the army rations. And we just had a wonderful time there. I got on extremely well with the old priest, and he wanted to learn English, etc. And so I had sessions with him, teaching him the basics of English. Lisa was quite good at languages, and we had no great problem there. And it was a very happy time, and this continued for a matter of weeks. And then, one morning, we heard tremendous roaring overhead, which we were woken by. Looking out, I well remember it. whole sky became filled with the planes towing gliders. And although we didn't know what was happening, because it was the beginning of the so-called Market Garden offensive, where there was that tremendous airborne assault, etc. And so we're fascinated to see these planes going over and realize that things were being quite active. But again, it was difficult to get precise information of just what was happening. But we were thrilled to know that something was indeed happening. And then the priest became ill. He was probably about in his mid-80s, I expect. And Lisa was very, very concerned. And then the priest died, unbelievably. And we paid our due respects. And at that stage, Lisa insisted that we still stayed in the house. And arrangements were made for the priest's body to be put on show, if you like, to his parishioners. And I will remember this. I played a part in fitting up a sort of display area with curtains around and carrying the priest's body into this area and helping to arrange it and so on. And quite frankly, I suppose one of the parishioners would have come and helped, but Lisa insisted that all this was being done very, very properly, and so I was only too happy to help. And then things changed overnight. The priest's sister and other relatives came, and immediately she was a bit of a virago and took command. Within an hour, we were told to get out and had to leave the place and return to our trucks. And so there was no more cooking for Lisa, and we're back sleeping in our trucks whilst his sister took charge of everything in the vicarage itself. And then one evening, Lisa came to us in our truck, and she says she wanted our help. And she explained that over the years, it was the custom for an Easter offering to be given to the priest. And when they were concerned, he hadn't spent this offering, but it had been accumulated in bags down in the cellar. And as most of the offerings were in a small coin, over the years, these bags had become quite heavy and filled with small coins of the Easter offerings. And Lisa explained that his sister knew nothing about that, but once she got to know about it, she would no doubt appropriate the proceeds. And Lisa had been in touch with the priest in the next village, who said he would take over the offerings and deal with them appropriately. But the problem was getting them there. And so could we possibly secretly collect these offerings and get them to the priest in the next village? And so it was arranged one night, after everyone was settled down and so on, in their beds, about midnight, that Lisa had left the door open and was quietly inside waiting for us. And so a couple of us went down to the cellar, took these bags of coin, put them on our vehicles, and drove to the next village where the priest was waiting up for us and handing them over. And we really enjoyed doing that little bit of service and so on. And to cut a long story short, it wasn't too long after that when we were on the move again and obviously making towards Germany and in due course the Rhine.
So what happened then? Actually, before we go on, there's just one thing that I think you may have missed out, but we best deal with that. This is that there was a village of Ornay that you went
That's
through.
Right.
That would be in August, I would imagine.
I missed that out completely.
July. Now, just can you just tell us that story? Because it seems to you. I know you've revisited it. Just tell me what the situation was at Ornay.
I should have referred to this before, and this happened a short time after the initial landings. And when we were just advancing down into France. And I, again, had the overall responsibility for ensuring that communications were going all right. And as you probably gather, I tended to work very independently. And I decided I had to go up towards the forward formations and make contact and make sure that things were okay. And so I drove down through Normandy and down beyond Caen, from Bayeux to Caen and south, and began to find that the country was quite devastated, that there had been extreme fighting and so on, and enormous damage done everywhere. And then I approached a little town called Ornay-sur-Redon. I was on my own and so on. As I drove down towards it, there was a long road, perhaps about a mile, I suppose, a straight road leading down to a valley, and there one saw in the distance was just the spire of a church. And in approaching, I realized that here was a place that had been absolutely devastated. And as I got near to it, I saw it was nothing but a heap of rubble, an enormous heap of rubble, with just the spire of the church still standing. And bulldozers had been at work clearing a path through it. The town itself was standing on the crossroads, and what they were doing was making a way through the rubble just to link up with the crossroads. It was very hot weather then, and in the area around, I so well remember the fields where there'd been cattle. The cattle were lying on their back with their four legs in the air and their bodies blown up like a balloon as they were deteriorating. And so when I got nearer this heap of rubble, which was Ornay-sur-Redon, again, the stench was shocking, because there was obviously trapped beneath the rubble the many bodies that hadn't been able to be pulled out or dealt with. And that scene always remained in my mind. And I took the opportunity after the war on a number of occasions when I was over in France to go to Ornay-sur-Redon. And there was a completely rebuilt town. the story of its rebuilding is quite wonderful. Apparently, considerable assistance after the war was given by the Swedish government, believe it or not, in helping them rebuild. And the whole town had been beautifully reconstructed. I was therefore a fairly frequent visitor there, and whenever we're over in France with members of the family or other friends, I would always get an excuse to drive down via Ornay and stop over there and just give a little explanation of what had happened. And indeed, in a wonderful way, on the occasion of the celebrations of the landings, we were accommodated in Ornay with a wonderful French family. And that family we have maintained very close contacts with to this very day. Indeed, we have been there several times, and they've been over here, and we've established a very close friendship with them. And so Ornay had a very special part in my experience and in my memory.